Some irony there, right? There's a little bit of irony there. Yeah.
There's always irony.
Yeah. Always and everything. That's it.
Welcome to our second panel sponsored by the InfoSystem, the Aaron organization. The topic tonight is poverty. We cannot do justice to the topic without including our view about a city. Madison has approximately 209,000 people. There's a belief that every home should have a hot lunch and a warm place to live. But the reality is different. There is poverty. There's also the belief that in the spirit of knowledge, that education is the pathway to lift us away from poverty. That is our topic today, education and poverty. We have a panel members. We have Mr. Bob Howard, social worker in our schools. We have Tom Peplin, researcher at the Poverty Institute. We have Maria Covarrubias, representing herself as an individual who lives herself from migrating to Madison and now being a teacher. We have Mr. Ray Allen, owner of Madison Times, and we have Mary Kate Baum from representing Urban Ministry. We'd like to start our topic today with Tom Kaplan, Professor Tom Kaplan, to give us a definition of what poverty from research.
Do you want me to just sit here?
Hand the microphone down.
Sure. I'm going to sit here, so.
Okay, now I'm going to sit here. let me first tell you officially what poverty is. Poverty is, in the United States, is simply income below a certain income threshold. Many of you know what that threshold is. It's, but sometimes people are shocked by how low these numbers seem. It depends how large your household is. If you live in a household of one, then the poverty threshold is $9,570 of income per year. For two people, $12,830. Three people, $16,090, and for four people, $19,350, and it goes up from there. The way we've got to this definition of poverty is kind of convoluted, and in some ways doesn't make a lot of sense, but this all started in the 1960s when President Johnson wanted to wage a war against poverty. But he was hampered by the fact that he didn't know who was poor or how many people were poor. And so he asked for a very fast effort by the agency in the government that at that time seemed to know the most about poverty, and that was the Social Security Administration, asked them to do a quick effort to figure out how many people were poor. So that he could know whether he would he'd be able to measure whether he was winning or losing in the war against poverty. So the task fell to a longtime researcher, and she only had about a month to work on this and come up with an answer. So the first thing she did, because she had worked in the Department of Agriculture before working for the Social Security Administration, was that she knew that there was a standard in the Department of Agriculture for how much money a person had to spend on an adequate food diet, and that was arranged by family size or by household size. And she knew from another survey that had been done in 1955 that the average family spent a third of their income on food. And so she figured if she could go and figure out through the Department of Agriculture work how much a family had to spend to have a minimally adequate nutritious diet, she could just multiply that times 3 and come up with the poverty thresholds. And that's what she did. And it turned out for a family of 4, which at that time was the standard family size, it's closer to 3 now, that it was about $3,300 a year. And then that went up the chain of command, and her bosses thought it would be a good idea to round that to $3,000 per year for a family of 4. And then that was adjusted for household sizes that were larger and smaller than a family of 4. So that is essentially how we came to the definition of poverty in the United States. Many other countries do it differently. In most European countries, it's something like one-half the median income. So it's a much more kind of conscious understanding in these European countries that poverty is relative, that as the general standards of living rise, it seems like what's poor should or could rise as well. In the United States, we don't do it that way. We simply have this flat income threshold, and it's never, in one sense, it's been adjusted since these efforts in the mid-1960s, but in another, in the most important sense, it's never been adjusted. That is, all we've done since then is increase the poverty thresholds by the annual change in the overall cost of living. But we have never stepped back and said, in 1965 it wasn't uncommon for people, particularly in rural Appalachia, to live in homes without indoor plumbing. Now it's relatively uncommon throughout the United States. We adjust the poverty thresholds to reflect the fact that our general standards of living have changed. We haven't done that. Again, the only thing we've done is adjust for the overall increase in the cost of living. We've also not adjusted these thresholds for the fact that food over time has, as a portion of people's income, risen, as a portion of people's income, the cost of food has gone up much more slowly than have the cost of other things that people spend money on. So the typical family now spends about a sixth of their income on food, not a third of their income. So if you're going to follow the old method, but revise it just based on the fact that families now spend a different portion of their income on food, we take what the minimal cost of a market basket of food that was necessary to provide adequate nutrition, and we'd multiply it by 6 rather than by 3. And our poverty thresholds would be twice what they are. But we've, lots of other things have changed since the mid-1960s that we've also not adjusted for, and some of those things work in the other direction. In the mid-1960s, we had no food stamp program. Now we do. In the mid-1960s, there was no such thing as an earned income tax credit. Now the earned income tax credit is by far the largest federal program supporting low-income people in the United States. But we don't count people's food stamp income or their earned income tax credit as income when we calculate people's income and compare it to the poverty thresholds. So if we did that, that would reduce the percentage of people who are counted as officially poor. Lots of other things have changed. Some researchers some years ago were called together by Congress and asked to propose a different way of measuring poverty. And lots of things were proposed. Many people think that instead of measuring income, we should measure consumption. That is why, why do we care what people's income are? What we should really care about, said these folks, is what people are spending money on. And we don't do that, and that is, we don't measure people's consumption and try to determine whether they're poor based on their consumption patterns, primarily because we don't have good surveys that measure people's consumption. But some people suggested that we should go to the European standard, having a relative threshold for poverty. The Census Bureau, which does all the calculations, determines how many people are poor based on these income thresholds each year, did some figuring trying to adjust for the fact that some income that people have, like the Earned Income Tax Credit, isn't counted for, but on the other hand, people's food, the percentage of their income that they spend on food has changed. And it turned out that the thresholds, when they did all of these calculations, to the best that they were able to, it turned out that the poverty threshold rose somewhat. A bigger effect, though, was that different people were poorer than are officially poor. There were a lot more under these alternative poverty measures. A lot more elderly people are poor than is the case in the official poverty statistics. When we say a lot of times in talking about schools, people say, well, folks are poor, and the way we measure poverty is by how many are eligible for free and reduced school lunches. And that's simply using the poverty thresholds, but multiplying them by a factor. So the reduced school lunch program, you're eligible for that at 185% of the poverty threshold. And the full school lunch program, you're eligible for that at 130% of the poverty threshold. Many programs that use the poverty threshold for determining eligibility for the program use some percentage of the poverty threshold. So I think the W-2 program in Wisconsin uses 115% of the poverty threshold. Medicaid and Badger Care in Wisconsin now go up to 200% of the poverty threshold. The same with the child care benefits. So how people arrive at these percentages that are something different than the absolute poverty threshold has always been a curiosity to me. I think there's just some sense that the poverty threshold is too low. And that we ought to do something, so people kind of negotiate and they come up with this percentage, and then it becomes, it's still tied to the poverty threshold, but it's something a little bit greater, like the free and reduced school lunch program. Questions that folks often ask about this: how long are people poor? Is there intergenerational poverty, and to what extent does poverty reproduce itself? And the answers are all over the lot. That is, some poverty in this country. Again, we don't care about poverty that is less than a year. That is, we ask people in surveys, we ask them generally in April of each year, what was your income last year, in the last calendar year? And for people who had very low income for a couple months, but you know, somewhat better income for the rest of the year. We're not concerned officially in our official poverty statistics about those couple months when they didn't have sufficient money. We are only asking them what was their annual income. So the very short-term poverty we don't know very much about. Longer-term poverty, that is people who are poor for more than 1 year, for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, it turns out that about half the people who are poor in any 1 year are likely to be poor next year. And about 40% being poor for 2 years in a row makes you more likely to be poor for a longer period of time. About 80% of those people will be poor for 3 years, and it goes down from there. Intergenerational, that is, people whose parents were poor. That we don't know so very well. Our Census Bureau doesn't ask those kind of questions. There is, the University of Michigan has been running since the 1960s a long-term survey of people who were poor in the 1960s, and now they're following their children and their grandchildren. In any 1 year, about 60% of the people who were poor in the 1960s have descendants who are poor after that.
So it sounds to me that the whole concept of poverty is like in terms of understanding that it was still a steady concept. And Yet there's a lot of perceptions when we walk away to the everyday person. What do you think of poverty? So, and that's where we look at the language of images. Language of images by Neil Post suggests that through movies, television, radio concept, it gives images of what poor people, who are the poor people and what makes poor people. And that goes to magazines, it goes to radio, it goes to advertisement. So I invited Mr. Ray Allen to talk about Madison Times. He's the owner of Madison. Why do we need a Madison Times in Madison? Why?
I think one of the things that put this in a somewhat of a perspective is that I think the images that we saw out of New Orleans speak louder than any words I can say. The image were of people of color who were poor. And when we talk about poverty in America, if you look at any magazine, any story that's done on poverty in America, whether it's Newsweek or Time, you'll notice that 99.9% of the time, the image you see on the cover of that magazine is of someone of color. And certainly we know that there are non-minority people in America who are poor. But they never seem to appear in our papers, in our magazines, or even in our movies. And what that really does is have a very negative effect, I think, on self-esteem issues for particularly children, but also for families. Because there's a lot of assumptions that go with poverty, that they don't want to work, kind of old Reagan theory that I looked, opened up the magazine paper, and there's all these jobs here, and everybody should have one.
Yeah.
And that these folks are just lazy.
Yeah.
That there is a connotation with criminal behavior, that because they are poor, they're more susceptible to be criminals and do all kinds of bad things. There's the other perception that they're just reproducing at some high rate and not taking care of their children and leaving them for the rest of society. I think it's important for Madison Times or any other newspaper that's a community newspaper to focus on positive aspects of a community that are traditionally labeled in the press with negative images and negative stereotypes, whether they're criminal or not. I've always had a problem. I had this conversation with the State Journal a number of times, who was one of my former employers, by the way. Whenever they would mention my name in connotation with being on the board or anything else, it was always I was black. Now, there are other people on the board who are white. They don't say, you know, white board member Ruth Robards. Or the other connotation, you know, short board member. Draw back. Why is this always an image that we have to portray? And really the effect of that is really personal for those of us, I think, of the community of color. Now, I'll just use my children. I try not to use my children as examples. But in this instance, when I first moved into Parkwood Hills, which is on the west side, which is a nice, rather upscale, middle-class neighborhood. And we went to John Muir School, which you're very familiar with. I know many of you. I would often drop my daughter off early at school because I had to be at work, obviously. But she would go early, and I found out that they were feeding her the free and reduced lunch. Free and reduced breakfast in there. And I went to talk to the principal, who I won't mention at the time, and said, well, why are you doing this? I mean, the kids eating at school. They had all just made an assumption, because she was African-American, that she was poor. Now, I don't think he had any malintentions of doing that. I actually thought he was probably doing a favor. But my point is that these images kind of embed themselves in all of us. They're negative images. And we don't have enough that balances that off. And it's very unfortunate. And I think, truly believe, that it has an effect on our children in their believability of their capability to achieve. If you believe everybody, or are told everybody, that looks like you is poor, is unsuccessful, and every other negative stereotype, it's going to have an effect. Now, certainly a lot of people overcome that. There's hundreds of examples, but there's a lot of children who don't. I didn't know I was disadvantaged until I came to the University of Wisconsin at the time, that through their study programs, that everybody black here was disadvantaged. I didn't know that, because I just didn't know any better, I guess. But I think we give our children that stigma, and it becomes a very difficult act for them to move forward, because now they're always finding real or illusionary barriers, because that's what it does. They're believing that every time something occurs to them, it's discrimination. Because we create an imagery that you're going to be discriminated against because you're poor, because you're a minority. And it gives them such a negative self-esteem that for some, it takes a whole lifetime to work themselves out of that.
It's hard sometimes to separate our concepts of poverty and sometimes to separate our own beliefs from poverty. But the human being who experiences poverty, the human being who has the will, the human being who searches to succeed, yes, moves forward and keeps and protects the spirit. I like what Ms. Covarrubias used to tell us, how to lift herself up from arriving to Madison and working as a, well, she can do it better. Ms. Covarrubias, what do you tell us about your experience?
Well, we came looking for that American dream in the fall of 1979 to California. We were migrant workers in California. We had a child, 5 months old, and the crops were done, so we needed to move on. And we got an offer to come to Wisconsin. We didn't even know where Wisconsin was. Much less that it was in the middle of the winter and the white snow was very cold. And so we came to Madison, Wisconsin in January of 1980 and to work for Stokely USA back then in Wanakee. Now it's not anymore even there. But we encountered many barriers, that's true. But we also had energy, we had a dream, and I don't know, just the fulfillment of self-realization. First, I needed to learn English because I went to the store and I could not even, I opened container after container after container because I was looking for sour cream. ended up buying a whole thing of other things that I didn't need. So that was my first goal, to learn English. And my grandma always said that you cannot buy more than you can chew. And in Spanish, of course. But so little by little, first I learned, you know, I learned a little bit of the language. And then I had more children. Actually, I have a total of 5 kids. Then we moved to Illinois. Then we came back to Madison. So we moved around for about 5 years until finally we decided this is the place to raise the kids. So we moved into the low-income housing Wexford Ridge, right across the street from Jefferson Middle School. And think about it, coming from the barracks of California, from Illinois, really low-income housing, to Madison, Wisconsin. Even if the low-income looked like heaven, I mean, they had playgrounds for the kids. Everything was, green. I mean, it was just really different. I didn't know I had all those labels until I was really embedded in the language. Really not realizing who was a low-income person, why, your color, everything comes apparent once you become embedded in the language because you understand much more of what other people are saying. So, and thinking about, your income levels, I was thinking, my husband and I, between both of us, we have 3-4 jobs going. And in 1986, we make about $3,000 between both of us. In about 87, we made $5,000. So we were going up. We're going up the scale. little by little, I learned a little more English. I started working with a parent program. It was called the Triple P back then, the Primary Parent Participant, at John Muir Elementary. And one of the things that I have is, I always set small goals. I always loved school, always, since I was really little. And one of the things that I keep telling my kids is, yes, you can do it. You can do it. But they needed to see me doing it. You know, you cannot tell your kids, don't smoke because it's bad for you, and then you're, you know, like a chain smoker. It doesn't work that way. You have to show them, you know, this is the way you do it. And so, little by little, first, you know, I learned the English so that I can tell my daughter, yes, you can learn it too. Then I learned, then I went to METC. And back then, I took the bus every single day to METC from Wexford, you know, from Westtown to METC. And the kids back then were really good. I mean, I'd sit them in the back of the room. Teachers, very accommodated. I could take my classes. The kids will be eating in the back. No problem. Took a couple of hours sitting in the back taking care of each other while I was taking classes. But people were very accommodating to me. And I think that if people see that the sign on you, and not only see it, that you're talking about the desire you have, the goals you have, but you're showing them that you also have this desire, they are willing to help you. You know, so then everybody was just helping me with different things. After that, I got my GED, my high school equivalency diploma, because I went back and took two more classes or whatever. I ended up finishing up with 272 points when I only needed 250. So my husband keeps saying to me, I will keep working. You have the brains. You have to keep going. You know, and he will say, you know, I'm such a donkey. I can't learn. I will keep on working hard. You keep on going to school. Show the kids you can do it. They will do it too. So again, setting up small goals. I thought, I never, I swear in a million years I was going to be able to go to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I thought, I'm fine with a GED. I'm working for schools. I was working for a school, working with the kids with, special education. Thank you. I was in SEA. Then later on, I got into ESL, English as a Second Language, and I was helping as a bridge. I was bringing people from the community that only spoke Spanish into the school so they can feel okay coming in and asking for different things. So I think they also saw my pride. I will take pride in my accomplishments, even the little ones. You know, even the little ones, we celebrated. Even when we didn't have a big cake, it was a small cake, but it was a celebration. You know, this is something to be celebrated for. Just becoming a planner. Okay, so now what are we going to do now? What are we going to do next? And becoming an advocate for yourself. You know, nobody's going to be an advocate for your children except you. So I will be there, and sometimes I will even ask the principals, and this has becoming a joke, because I will walk in and I will say, do you have your coffee yet? Because back in my country, they said, you know, gringos, all Americans needed to drink their coffee before you could talk to them. So I would walk in the morning to the office and say, Mr. So-and-so, you have your coffee yet? Can I talk to you? And then I will have a conversation with him, half in English, half with mimics. But, you know, he knew that I was there to see it for my children. So then, you know, little by little, they all finish up. Three of them are at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Two of them are already graduates. One is a teacher at Senate Middle School. One works at Lincoln. Because even though she finishes with she finished a bachelor's degree with behavioral sciences and law, she started working in schools and she just loves to be there with the kids. Forget law school. The other one is trying to get into the police academy here in Madison, and the other one is finishing up a business degree and Whitewater, University of Wisconsin Whitewater. And my baby now, she's a sophomore, and she is in her second year trying to get into the School of Ed with the Education Fellows Program. So little by little, I just show them, you know, it wasn't easy for me to work full-time, going to school full-time, and raise five kids. It wasn't easy, and I don't even know how I did it, but it was just little by little, and the whole seven of us are really, really tight. We really depend on each other, you know, to succeed. So when one didn't read the stuff, I was in classes with my kids, you know, and I will be the one asking the questions, and they will go like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe she's asking that question. I can't believe she's asking for accommodations, you know, and I will be like, excuse me, I need a couple more hours to take this test, or can I have an empty room where I can take it? And just to show them, it's okay. You're paying for this education. Nothing is free. You can do it. You can ask for stuff too. You know, ask and you will receive. So just, you know, I did it because I wanted to give my children, I wanted to show them the way. You know, it was very hard for me. It wasn't as hard for them. And hopefully it's not going to be as hard for my grandchildren. But I needed to show them the way. I needed to show them that, yes, we can do it, you know? And I didn't get into education or become a teacher, and now I just finished my master's in educational psychology. Why did I do that? Well, just because I wanted to understand the kids, how they were thinking, you know, especially what kinds of images did they come into their mind when they're in my classroom. I want to help them. That was the reason that I became a teacher. Not only for my own children, but for the other children that I can motivate, or the other parents that I can motivate. And when my parents come and say to me, can I come and sit here? I probably won't help you much, but, you know, and I said, if you can spend the time with your child, that's a time well spent. You know, just come in, sit down, help, anything. You know, you don't need to speak the language. You don't need to dress any fancier than I am, because I never am. But especially in the classroom. But I really like it when they come in into my room and they feel like they can make a little bit of difference in their own children's life. So, like my husband said, you know, we have the tool in the toolbox. We have our keys, and those keys can open any of the doors if we just keep on trying. So,
we have a life product of what a lot of researchers say about the human spirit. Robert Coles and many others who devoted time to human development. On the other hand, we have Medicine Times fighting the images that are projected by the media in terms of building up a positive image of our community of color. But then we have the framework that makes decisions, that identifies what's poverty for us. Now we want to here from Urban Ministry.
I can't address poverty and education without talking also about race. Because there is a race code that goes with much of our poverty. It's most vividly seen, I think, in unemployment figures. You know, this county, Madison, and the whole county has one of the lowest unemployment rates in the entire country. In the year 2000, when the regular census was taken, the unemployment for Dane County was 3.8%. This counts everybody, not just those who have filed for unemployment recently. And that was moderate. Wisconsin was 4.7%, and the entire country was 5.8%. So Dane County was a little more than half of what the entire country's unemployment rate was. However, the unemployment rate for African-American men in Dane County was 14.1%. And the national unemployment rate for African American men was only 12.3%. I say only. I mean, that's a very high number. But Dane County's unemployment rate for African American men was greater than the country's as a whole. At the same time that our own unemployment rate as a county was one of the lowest in the country. I believe that in our county, we have there are decisions regarding employment that are still being made on the basis of race. And one result of that is greater poverty among our children of color. For many years, I would point out that the statewide free and reduced lunch together percentages in our state were 33%, and in the Madison Metropolitan School District, it was 34%. So we weren't that much different from our state as a whole. However, the unemployment rate for African American children, and those figures I first gave you are for elementary school, which I think are the only accurate way to look at free and reduced lunch, because children at middle school and high school often aren't signed up for free and reduced lunch. It also gives you a good idea of where the population is going to because of the age. For years, the African American elementary students in the Madison School District had an 80% eligibility and usage of free and reduced lunches. Now, this last year, I just got the figures from the Department of Instruction, Public Instruction, and we as a school district have gone up to 40%. I can give you the exact amount.
38%.
38%? Yeah. Okay.
Or 42, somewhere in there.
I think it's 42 for elementary. Excuse me. Here it is. 40.4% for Madison Metropolitan School District elementary students who qualify and receive free and reduced lunches. While the statewide average stayed at 33%, they use the term black, the black elementary Madison Metropolitan School District, 80% of the black elementary school district students qualify for free and reduced lunch. So that has stayed at 80%. A very high percentage. And I think it is an indicator of employment of the parents. And I think also it's a housing correlates in a very similar fashion, in fact, almost too similarly, as does incarceration. Housing, in January of 2005, there's a count that happens nationwide on January 25th, or it's required by HUD, and in Dane County it was in January last year. And there were 1,066 people in shelter, or seeking shelter, and or living in cars or parks. This does not include those who were illegally doubled up or in unsafe residences. But of those individuals counted, 46% were members of homeless families with minor children. And on that date, temperatures in Dane County at that time were from 20 degrees to 40 degrees, and they dropped to a minus 2 degrees 2 days later. Both the city and the county have had waiting lists for Section 8 housing vouchers. Those waiting lists have been closed virtually for 2 years. The best indicator of stable housing is that you have subsidized housing at some point. 60% of the homeless families sheltered in the Dane County Family Homeless Shelter for families were African American. and 86% of the families served in any of our shelters considered themselves non-white. 932 children stayed at least one night in a Dane County shelter last year. And the thing that, it's anecdotal, but it's helpful to get the picture. Caseworkers who are assisting these families repeatedly say that an African-American mother and children will be accepted for full-time work and for permanent housing many months after a Caucasian mother and her children, even when each mother has the same job skills, same credit rate record, same number and age of children. And it's very discouraging for those people working in the system. The graduation rates also follow a color code. Maybe our next speaker will get more into that. I can say that because my family is of the Oneida Nation, 74% of the Native Americans who enter 12th grade graduate. While of all those who enter 12th grade, 80 of all races, 85.4% graduate. Hispanic graduates, it's only 63% of Hispanics who enter 12th grade that graduate of 12th grade. African-American, 72%. I bring up incarceration because I think it's very connected. You can't have a state that that has 5% African-American population and almost 50% of the persons in our prisons being African-American and there not being something going on, especially because those numbers increase so greatly to such disparities since the drug.
Yes. We're going to miss in here.
Sorry.
We'd like to come back to the topic of poverty and education, and it sounds to me that you have given us some data that is real. We can walk out of here pretty depressed about it. But not forgetting one key thing, you know, that you bring about is that this institutional racism that exists not only in Madison but throughout the United States. The same Madison Times is fighting that institutional racism, right? And we have, but we do have the spirit, like Maria, who lifts herself up against all sounds. And we do have the framework of decision makers. What are we going to do? What do we need to do? And how are we going to make our decisions? That's where you, the public, make a difference. And that's where bringing this program to you. I'd like to hear from Mr. Howard on some of that hope that there is.
Oh.
We work together many times. We can talk from Broadway Simpson neighborhood. Now is Lake Point. Some of those youngsters were there. Now they have ended up with a bachelor's degree. They're working. I remember about a year ago, I went to a Century and I saw a little boy there who was once a little boy living in that neighborhood and said, I'm the manager here, Century. So there's a lot of things that are happening in our community that are lifted. Mr. Howard, give us some hope.
Thanks. Well, I first would like to say that I was a little upset with Mr. Gomez because I'm going to say this because I felt really a lot of anxiety about coming tonight because I felt like I got a late invitation from Mr. Gomez, bless his soul, but I really wanted to come and be a part of it out of my respect for Mr. Gomez and my long-standing friendship with him and because this topic is such an important one. So I decided to come. I quickly tried to grab some information together to try to sound smart and not embarrass myself and embarrass him. I'm feeling pretty good right now because it was really, I'm feeling lucky to be at the end because I'm going to weave through a lot of what people have said and put maybe some flesh and fill it out a little bit. We heard some data about the media. We had a real live story here that was really touching in a way was a lot of ways my story. And then hearing from Mary Kay about what the district is looking like in poverty and people of color, and specifically black people. I would say, I'm from Milwaukee, And I didn't know that I was disadvantaged or not adequately prepared for college when I came here in 1970 either. I was from a poor family, but everybody around me was poor, more or less. And we were happy and fed and clothed. And I had a pretty stable neighborhood where I lived. When I came here in 1970, it was a culture shock in a lot of ways. And hearing people speak proper English, and seeing people, you know, have skills and backgrounds and the depth and breadth of information that I really didn't have coming from the city, I quickly felt some of that self-esteem issue that Ray was talking about, that many other people talked about on the panel. I felt very inadequate, quickly began to feel very inadequate about being here. As a matter of fact, I flunked out of UW for a whole lot of reasons, all of which were mine. I flunked out of UW, but my dad was a veteran and a hard-working, no-nonsense guy, and I got my rear back in school real fast and finished up with a degree in social work. And, you know, talking about Milwaukee right now, Milwaukee looks racially, this is by the Milwaukee Journal the other day, racially and economically exactly like New Orleans did before the hurricane. And that's my city right now. We talk about Madison. We got a lot of folks coming from Madison to Madison because this image of it being such a great place to live, you know, it's top of the list of all the positive things that one would look for in a community, in a city, and that's attractive to everybody. And people of color see that and hear that and think that there's work here and opportunity here, and they come, and it's a culture shock when they realize that the type of work that's here and the type of barriers that are here and the high cost of living that's here and racism that's here and on that's here, it's really difficult for folks. And I thought I came here, you know, for myself, I thought I came here halfway prepared. And think of those folks who don't come nearly with what I thought I came with. I'm going to talk a little bit about district. This is only going to be an hour, so I'm going to talk really fast, which is okay. but I saw some things that hit me, and I would like to say them tonight. I think this is part of the problem. This is an article out of the Milwaukee Journal. I read the journal almost every day, Thursday, August 4th of this year, by William Raspberry. In 1890, 80% of black American households were headed by husbands and wives. 1890. That was just 25 years after the end of the Civil War. In 1900, the percentage was almost mostly unchanged. And it stayed that way through the 70s and 80s. Approximately 1970, it started to go down. 64% of black households were husband and wife. By the year 2000, the census in 2000, the percentage of black families headed by married couples was 38%. The only good news about this is from 1990 to 2000, it was about the same as what we're reporting. So we think we might have kind of bottomed out and it's not going to get any worse. Now consider this. Fatherless families are America's single largest source of poverty. The Annie Casey Foundation's Kids Count once reported that Americans who failed to complete high school, get married, and reach age 20 before having their first child, those folks were nearly 10 times as likely to live in poverty as those who did these three things: finish high school, get married, and not have kids before they were 20. I think as I look at the kids in the families in poverty, the kids in poverty in the district, and I can just skip right to that a little bit. In the state of Wisconsin, we have, according to the Madison Times article of a couple of days ago, September 15th, 187,000 children in this state living in poverty. 187,000 kids. Some of that data that this young man talked about earlier, percentages and what and what that poverty, what those poverty levels are. For the school district, it's about what we were hearing earlier. At the elementary schools, 42% of our kids live in poverty. And I'm going to give a couple of glaring schools at the elementary level that are really of alarm to me. 60% at Alice Elementary School. And then think about where those kids are coming from. If you know the layout of the district and where kids, neighborhoods that kids are coming to for particular schools, 60% low income as measured by free and reduced lunch. 76% at Glendale Elementary School, which is right by Senate and La Follette. 63% at Hawthorne. 62% at Lakeview. 70% at Lindbergh Elementary. 73% at Mendota Elementary School. Those are some of the higher ones in elementary school. The middle school, we have 41%. I just pulled this off the district's website today. So, and this is at the third week. We do official count at third week, so that should be pretty accurate. 41% of all middle school students live in poverty. 41%. And the highest one, let me see, 79%, almost 80%, Wright Middle School. My school that I work in, Jefferson Middle School, has 25% poverty, low income, I should say. I was one of those kids for a while. My dad had some periods of unemployment, and I remember feeling really bad about going to school. He was laid off. He was a laborer. He was a machinist, but he was laid off from time to time. I'm the oldest of 8 kids in Milwaukee. And I remember going to Riverside High School in Robert Fulton. It's now Malcolm X Academy, right in the center of the city of Milwaukee. And I remember not wanting to go to school a whole lot. I remember crying a whole lot because I knew I didn't look and dress like the other kids, like many of the other kids. I felt inadequate, especially at Riverside High School, because my family just didn't have it. When I was young, growing up, my dad wasn't really established, and he was a hardworking guy, but he didn't make a lot of money, and blah, 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 blah. He's dead now, but by the time the family matured, and he had years of work, and I was out of the household, the money was there, a lot more. And so my siblings benefited from better financial standing that I didn't have growing up. But I benefited because he pushed me to go to school. And I believe in going to college, and I believe that that's been the most significant thing that's led to my 2 boys. I have 2 boys, Nick and Martin Howard, and Nick is in Dallas, Texas. Nick just graduated out of the UW School of Business with a degree in business administration. He's working in Dallas, Texas. He started at $55,000 a year. And my other son's a senior at UW now, School of Business, and he's going to graduate next May. And I was the first in my immediate and fairly extended family that went on to college and graduated. I got a degree in social work, like I said, and now I can just rattle off a nephew, a niece, a cousin, a nephew, my sons. And the expectation is that their kids, they're already hearing about you're going to college and you're going to do this, and the parent support to do what it takes to have those kids ready for college. I kind of forged that path for my kids, and you know, I dare to say, they're very talented kids. They're very talented kids, but I gotta believe they're very smart kids. They're smarter than I am. But I gotta believe they'd be in severe trouble trying to do it if they didn't have me as a model blazing that path for them. Just like this young lady did for her kids. Many of the kids that I work with at Jefferson Middle School, holy cow, I'm just really happy to be there. I can give you a story today. I took I took three young boys, three African American boys, who are in this poverty. They count in this poverty. They receive free and reduced lunch. They live on Allied Drive. Their mother died this past May. The grandmother, the matriarch of the her three daughters, she's got 12 kids. She's got one of her daughters in jail. One of them deceased now, last May, and the other one who's AOD involved, and severely impoverished family. And we have a slush fund at Jefferson. This is the first slush fund I've ever had in my 23 years of working in schools. We took those three boys out today. They have not wanted to come to school. They are already identified truant. And part of that reason is because they have the same kind of problem that I had when I was in middle and high school. I didn't want to go because I knew I was clean, but I didn't have a lot of clothes. These kids are dirty and they have no clothes. The three boys have been wearing 70% of the days that they've come to school, they've had on the same clothes. They know it, the other kids know it, the teachers know it, and they know that everybody else knows it. So we took those kids out today, the psychologist and I, and we spent about $500 out of a slush fund that we have at Jefferson Middle. That was raised by teachers and our PTO, and our principal just decided we're gonna take liberty with this. It's for low income families, and we're gonna do what we need to do to help this particular family. I think that's the kind of thing that we've got to do. Einstein, I'm not gonna do this verbatim, but Einstein says something like, "You can't solve problems," and anybody who knows it exactly should spit it out. You can't address problems and solve problems at the same level at which they were created. Anybody know that Einstein quote? Well, you know, to me it's kind of the cliche, get outside the box. It's doing something different and new and unique. We got this problem. It's not new. We've had poverty in this district for a pretty good while. And we've been talking about it for a pretty good while. And I see 23 years worth of poverty, and most of it is kids of color, disproportionately kids of color, and most of that is black, African American kids. And I think we need to be creative and do something, take some risks, take some positive risks and calculated risks to address some of the stuff that's going on. And today was an example of that. I think that the agencies and programs that exist in this city, of which there are many, but that help kids and families that are struggling, but many of them individually are struggling to raise funds and to do what they need to do, and there's room for a lot of collaboration. And I think those programs, 100 Black Men and Juventud and Bootstraps and all of the ones that are out there, I'm not going to do justice by naming, but there's many of them that I've worked with in 23 years. PPP, who's not around anymore, that work with kids and families, and there needs to be more collaboration. I see holes in servicing these kids and families that could be reduced if those agencies and programs would do a little more talking about it, and maybe Ray and the Madison Times could do something to help make that happen. Talking to the programs that are out there that focus on servicing kids and families, and to the extent possible, and when those opportunities arise, collaborate. You put those bucks together and you can do much more as a result, where you couldn't do as much with your little money in and of yourself.
Mr. Howard, you have to...
I've got to wrap it up. Let me just say this. I'm feeling cheated because I'm on the tail end. But let me say this real fast. You know, on an individual, on a day-to-day kid basis, every day going to school with these kids want everything that kids that are not in poverty want. They can do as well as any of the kids not in poverty. They work as hard. Their parents want as much of them in education as the kids that don't come from poverty. They need a lot of support in terms of modeling. These kids don't have models that represent success. They do have models that represent sometimes earning money, but it's illegal money, and it's risky business out there. So they have those kind of models. We need to have positive, successful models that represent safe and real opportunities for the kids that are education-based. So helping these kids realize that they can do it, helping provide models for them, helping them establish goals. Me and people that look like me and look like them have to be there for these kids and help these kids learn not only to set those goals, but what it takes to reach and attain those goals. You know, many of the kids that are not in poverty, and I'm going to quiet up real fast, Mr. Gomez, but many of those kids that don't come from poverty, they have, what's the word I'm looking for? This unspoken, natural, everyday lessons about how to make it, because their parents are working, have good education, have a work ethic, go to work every day, do the budget. You know, all those things that we take for granted as middle class folks, our kids are learning and see them and see them represented, and we do them. And the kids that are coming for poverty often don't have that kind of modeling and that kind of everyday experiences where they can see it operationalized. We tell it to them, but if you can't go home and feel it and see it and do it every day and see your parent doing it, you need somebody else out here to do it for you and to provide that. So that's what I see as my role. How do you do this? You can do it, and to model some of that stuff.
Mr. Howard, we want to have to stop here.
It's really a challenge in the communities is that you've got now so many grandparents raising their grandchildren, which has a dual effect, that it keeps the grandparents at a level of poverty that probably wouldn't occur because they're supporting, you know, an extended family. And I think any of us who have raised children know what energy it takes to raise a child. And I can't imagine having grandchildren going through the cycle again to have to raise them and go through all the events and the support that is necessary. It's just got to be a tremendous challenge on a person as their age, like me, to do that. I have tremendous respect, but I think it's also a major problem and concern that we need to address.
Yes?
One thing. Just give me one thing that you would want to see happen to address poverty and education, to bring kids in poverty into the educational system and help them be successful. There's one thing.
Adopt a school. Give them a school. Adopt a school.
But from an institutional point of view, from a societal point of view, you're telling me what I can do, and that's great. But systematically, I mean, what do we as a society, or what do we as a school district need to do to make sure that kids in the poverty succeed in school?
We need to diversify the staff. Those kids need role models. They need to see themselves many times. In my school, at Chavez Elementary, and any other school that I have been, I am the tough teacher, or I am the something teacher, because I do things different. I talk to the kids in the way that the parents talk to them. You know, I don't go around sugaring things or anything. You know, this is what I need from you, and this is what you need to do. Period. There are clear and cut standards that we need to follow, and they don't see that. We need role models. They need to see themselves. They need to follow these other people.
I would agree with that. I can go to any school in this district and make a difference. Not by overtly doing anything myself.
Just by being there,
and the kids will appreciate that and understand what that means, and then after a while, staff will start referring things that I think they should have been doing themselves. They'll start telling me to do this, and I say, these are all our kids. You know, I may be able to connect whatever, but you're not trying. So I think we've got to diversify our staff, but in the meantime, because that's not going to happen real fast. We need to raise the consciousness and the skills and the abilities of our staff that is not of color, our Euro-American staff.
So we have to have more professional development.
I agree with both of those things, but at the same that the child who comes to school hungry or has been homeless within the last mm-hmm. year is not going to do as well in school, likely. And all the statistics show that. Mm-hmm. And at this very moment, this very week, our Congress is deciding on its budget. And they almost cut food stamps, but it's and they may still yet this week. Certainly, lots of other domestic programs are on the chopping block, and congregations and faith communities have been trying to fill in with eviction prevention funds administered through joining forces for families, and lots of things done at the local level. But we can't pick up, and we shouldn't pick up what is the moral responsibility of the whole country, which is to have a budget that prioritizes every child being able to grow up with food and a house over a roof over their heads.
So it goes back to decision makers.
Yes.
Getting involved to decision. Do you have a question?
I just add one quick thing to that. Let me give it a different spin. All those things being equal, that we have food stamps and we have the support, raise the expectations. Just because a child is poor, don't expect that they're going to fail. Mm-hmm. Expect that they're going to succeed. Mm-hmm. And that's an institutional problem.
Yeah. Totally true. I agree with that. You cannot lower expectations just because the kid has an accent. And I always say this. They might speak with an accent, just like me, but they don't think with an accent. So you cannot assume that just because they think the same as everybody else, as all of you, and just because we speak with an accent, that doesn't mean that we think with an accent. That we all, you know, we all are all in this together. So the expectation should be the same across the board, you know, for everybody.
So we should learn how to direct our services in teaching without excuses. Mm-hmm. There's no excuse. You can succeed. Anybody else with a question?
Yeah, I was interested in knowing, have you seen any incidents of poverty arising in families that previously were in the middle class coming as a result of job outsourcing and irresponsible corporate behavior and layoffs and that sort of thing resulting in impoverishment families that previously were
middle class? Talking about state employees?
State employees, private companies, people used to manufacture things.
Yeah. I think those two happen. I have experienced that, and what we have seen is that the resiliency that is there within the family, the struggle. The advantage here is, again, we look at the whole family system. And if the family is together, if the family, they unite as a group, and then they try to lift them up. This job's transitional. I think we're going to stop for tonight and thank the panel for being here.